It's Tuned to Yesterday with an hour of collection curios. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. The old-time radio collection at WRVO Public Media, known as the Ellen Robinson Memorial Library, contains tens of thousands of broadcasts on reel-to-reel tape, and there's a vast archive of the big-name shows from radio's yesteryear. But among the shelves are series with very few surviving episodes, one-off programs, underheard tapes, and long-considered to be rare broadcasts. In this hour, we get the reel spinning with programs not yet heard on our show, or at the very least, on the air in a very long time. Ahead of us are, for the most part, quarter-hour shows, with a body of the program that has survived. Later, you'll hear The Player, with actor Paul Frees providing all of the voices, a rare episode of Thrills of the Highway Patrol, music from The Smiley Burnett Show, but first, it's one of the many late-morning to early-afternoon radio programs that simply provided light chat to help get you through the day, featuring actor Adolf Monju with actor wife Varee Teasdale and their syndicated program Meet the Monjus, a show mostly heard out of New York station WOR at various times. New York Times critic Jack Gould regarded this show as easily among the most literate and enjoyable items on the daytime schedule. This broadcast is from in and about the year 1950.
Varee, it's getting so that I hate to drive the car downtown. Yesterday I crawled at a snail's pace through traffic and finally had to park 6 blocks from where I was going.
I know exactly what you mean, Adolf. If Los Angeles had adequate transportation facilities, I don't believe that I'd ever want to drive in congested areas.
With automobiles and trucks jamming every street in our cities, it certainly is time that drastic steps be taken to relieve this congestion.
Adolf, I suppose experts all over the country are constantly working on schemes to relieve traffic congestions in cities.
Well, of course they are, dear. The unfortunate part about it is that every city has a different problem. Now, I'm going to take the problem of Los Angeles and its suburbs, such as Beverly Hills and Glendale and the San Fernando Valley and the incredible traffic problems here. In the last 3 or 4 years, the number of registered vehicles has jumped almost 500,000 in the last 3 or 4 years. Almost 500,000 more than there were. Think of it.
Oh, I can believe that.
Now, what are we doing here to relieve that congestion? I have some ideas. I want to hear your ideas. You know more about New York. Tell us what New York has done.
Well, I don't
to help relieve its problem.
Well, yes, dear, but the problems are entirely different. I mean, out here, you have Los Angeles County, the area alone. The distances are so great in California, which I suppose is rather difficult for people in other parts of the country to realize that to go downtown to Los Angeles from Beverly Hills is, well, how many miles?
Well, I don't know the exact mileage, but in heavy traffic, it's a 45-minute run.
Well, at least. And that's hard driving all the way.
Yeah.
Now, you have from all the outlying districts, the people that come into Los Angeles every day. Unfortunately, we do not have adequate transportation in California through no fault of our own. We are not able to have subways.
No.
We don't have the elevated trains.
No.
We don't have regular railroad trains running into Los Angeles.
No, but there are things, there are some plans on foot to help relieve that. What I thought would be interesting would be to discuss how New York, which has had a very, very, very great problem, and probably a greater one than ours at its time, has helped solve it, because I've got solutions, you know, for solving the one here.
You have.
Oh, yeah.
Well, if you have any solutions for this traffic congestion here, you can make a fortune, because I doubt very much whether you have anything that's going to work very well.
Oh, would you like to hear some of mine first?
Yes, I don't mind. Go ahead.
Well, good. Now, every street shall have in the space large enough to park a car diagonally, not flush with the curb, shall have a parking meter. Over 1,000 cities in the United States have put orders in for parking meters. And every parking lot shall have a parking meter, because when a driver has to pay for his parking, he will not remain there. He will, and the congestion will be relieved by giving other cars a chance for a turnover. That's one scheme. Now, another scheme is a duplication of the famous underground garage in San Francisco, where you have a garage which goes 4 or 5 floors underground. There's lots of room in Beverly Hills and Los Angeles proper for underground garages. Also, as they have in Boston, overhead garages, huge ones, which will have spirals taking you clear to the top, or mechanical means of raising your car to the top.
Yes, dear, but those are wonderful ideas, except that they
You don't think they're going to help?
Well, dear, they may help, but they cost a great deal of money, and they take a long time to build. I mean, it's the immediate problem that is so frightening, particularly out here. Now, we have the new freeways, which are going through and will be completed, I suppose, in another year or so, from out in the valley and out along Long Beach and so forth. Yeah. That is only going to bring more people into Los Angeles. And there's another problem now. You see, in so many cities and throughout the country where they have congested traffic in the main part of their city, the people are able to park their cars on the outskirts of the city.
Yes.
And then come in either by trolley car or taxi or to walk. But out here, that's not possible because the outlying districts or the outskirts of Los Angeles proper might be 30 miles out. It never stops, and there's no place to park even there. It's an incredible problem.
The main problem, let's take downtown Los Angeles, as almost every city in the United States, the downtown business section, where the trucks have to unload from the airports, from the steamship lines, from the trains, where the trucks have to go down the streets, these huge, huge trucks. Now, that's where the problem is, the great problem, in the congested area. And an automobile is almost valueless in those narrow, congested streets. Now, it would be advisable for a person to park his car and walk in those particular sections, you see?
Well, yes, dear, but then you see that once more you're up against the same thing. Now, in New York, we have the island of Manhattan, which is approximately 14 miles long by 2.5 miles wide.
Yes.
Now, you think of the number of people that you know that live in New York City proper. How many of them have automobiles?
Not very many.
No, they don't need them. They don't need them at all.
No.
The people who work in New York City, so many of them come from either Long Island or New Jersey or Connecticut, all come in on the train.
What about Brooklyn, dear? Don't forget Brooklyn.
Well, I like Brooklyn. Never mind Brooklyn. They come in the subway, all right? Now, they come into New York on the train. Plus the fact that they have the subway, and they have wonderful bus service and crosstown buses and all of that. And with that, they still have a great problem. Don't misunderstand me, but it is nothing comparable to what we have here because the people in New York City do not have cars the way we do out here. But look how out here it's impossible, really it's impossible to get along in California, Southern California, without an automobile.
It's almost impossible. I agree with you. I agree. It's almost impossible. Now, what is your solution? My suggestion was this, the underground garage, the overhead garage, and the freeways, and the parking meters.
Yes, and just to make matters a little bit worse, do you see, even the enormous parking lots that we have out here right now, just think that in a few years' time, with the amount of building that's going on, all of those parking lots are going to be built upon.
Mm-hmm.
Now, where are the cars going then? That's what I would like to know. Have you any idea?
No, dear, I haven't the slightest idea.
You haven't?
I thought when I started that I was going to be able to solve everything, but it doesn't look very good.
You couldn't possibly solve anything if you tried on that score.
I wonder, dear, if all the congestion and traffic isn't a contributing factor to whether or not people attend the theater as often as they'd like to.
Well, I think that may have something to do with it. That and the critics.
Oh, yes, the critics. How often is the success or failure of a play entirely dependent on their reaction?
Well, not only a play, but practically every form of entertainment. Let's talk about critics after we listen for a moment to someone else.
Dear, for some time I've been wanting to ask you a question. What, in your opinion, is the function of a critic? And I don't mean only the one medium of the theater or pictures. I mean all forms of art, painting, writing, music. What is the function of a critic?
Well, I think that a critic is a specialized individual whose function is to criticize his particular field in order to guide the public.
Well, that's a good general definition, but do you think that a critic has a right to inject into his criticisms personal remarks about the artists,
what do you
musicians,
mean by,
the singers?
Well, what do you mean by personal remarks?
Well, I don't mind any personal remarks. I mean, I think that actor is very bad. I think that scene was played very badly. I think that the singer last night, his voice was very badly off. He was off key and off pitch and so on. Why doesn't he just simply come out and say, not his personal opinion, but from his own background and from his studies and from his knowledge of the medium, simply without injecting any personality into it?
But I don't see how he could be a good critic and do that at all.
You don't think
so? No, I don't think so. I think, now let us take the theater critic, for example.
All right.
In my opinion, a theater critic is simply a specialized playgoer.
Mm-hmm.
He is a man that has been picked because of the fact that he has a great knowledge of the theater, and he has made that his job. He spends most of his time studying the theater, going to plays, and if he has built a reputation for himself, his personal opinion in reviewing a play must appeal to a certain number of playgoers who over years have found out that they agree with him and they go to see a play that he likes.
Well, they have a great importance today also financially in the theater. While we're on the subject of the Greek Theater.
Yes, that's true.
A friend of mine told me the other day that if a play did not get favorable reviews from the first string, one, two, three critics, the first three, in among the New York critics, that his chances of success were nil. Do you believe that?
Well, I think that might be true, but I think that there are much deeper reasons for it than just the fact that it is the critic who is saying that. Today, as you know, in New York, but that's quite another problem. But at any rate, today in New York, it costs so much more to put on a play that unless they get excellent reviews from all of the critics that they know will mean money at the box office, the majority of producers cannot go along with the play over a period of 4 or 5 weeks, sort of nursing it along while the business is bad in the hopes it'll catch on. Mm. They can't do that anymore because it costs too much to produce a play. But let's get down to picture critics. Now, there's something else. I know that you have one pet peeve, so you might just as well express it about...
Well, that applies to the theater as well. It does not apply to the other forms of art, although it does to literature in a sense. I don't like to have the plot synopsized for me. I don't want to read a synopsis of the picture in the criticism or of the play.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to because it spoils it for me. That happens to be my disposition, that I want to be surprised when I go to the theater. Now, I don't mind a friend or a critic... saying, this is a wonderful play, this is great, but I don't want him to describe the third act climax, which makes it great, or the second act curtain, which makes it great, or the part of the film that makes it great. It spoils it for me.
Yes, but dear, just a moment. How in the world can a person criticize a play or a film, for example, without telling you why he likes it or why he dislikes it? How can he stand up there and say, I find this picture extremely entertaining, I like it, period. And he's not going to say, like it because it has great dramatic value, and the plot is thus and so, and it's very well played by whoever the people are, and there's a wonderful dramatic moment in the end of the film. He has to tell you those things. How often can he criticize it?
Dear, I agree with you. I'm most simply saying I may be a special case. I just don't happen to
You probably aren't.
Because it spoiled it for me. Now, I appreciate, as you do, the value of critics. They know their business. They've studied it. They've watched it. They couldn't hold down their positions if they didn't. You know, I only asked you in the beginning whether they should inject their own personal feelings into it.
Yes, I think so. I think that it is definitely a highly personalized job, and I think that the critic should give his personal opinion, and I think that it's a very, very interesting function that he plays in our lives. I don't know why anyone wants to be a critic, because most people don't have any sympathy for them, but that's the way it goes. Well, dear, once again, we must become conscious of the clock. It's time to say our goodbyes. This is Marie Teasdale Marjou speaking from Beverly Hills.
And this is Adolph Marjou saying how much we've enjoyed this visit with you. May we call again?
Meet the Monjus, in a syndicated broadcast from 1950. For years, Adolph Monjou was regarded as one of Hollywood's best dressed, which was probably helped by his wife's hobby for costume design, which he embraced after the run of their radio show. This is an hour of Collection Curios on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm Mark Levonier. Now time for the Smiley Burnett Show with music and comedy in a 15-minute program that came from a production house called Radio Ozark, which distributed programs with a Midwest sensibility in their entertainment, with stars like Gene Autry, who in the year following this broadcast starred alongside Smiley in the movie Whirlwind. This episode was released for syndication in 1950.
From Hollywood, it's the Smiley Burnett Show.
Well, I might have gone a-fishing.
Might have gone fishing.
I got to thinking it over.
Thinking it over.
The road to the river.
Ooh, it's a mighty long way.
It's a mighty long way.
It's the Smiley Burnett Show, transcribed with music by the Whippoorwills, songs by Sweet Georgia Brown and the Gay Rancheros, yours truly, Joe Slattery, and starring the clown prince of Western pictures, Smiley Burnett. Now here he is, that roly-poly son of the sage, Smiley Two Gun Burnett.
Yay! Yay!
Yes, yes. Well, I'm glad to see all of you again. I've been on a trip for a couple of days, and was I glad to get home. Boy, I was sure anxious to get me some good coffee. I must love coffee. I sure drink enough hot water trying to get it, you know. I stopped at one restaurant, and I ordered a meal, and when the waiter brought the food, I took one look at it, and I said, Bub, I can't eat this stuff. Call the manager. The waiter says, look, it's no use. He can't eat it either. I stopped in a little town out in Arizona. Hey, listen now. I stopped out in a little town there. Slim, Go on away from me. There was a cowboy having himself a good time, and he went over and stuck his head out of the hotel window and he yelled, "Fire!" Everybody did. I stopped into another cafe and ordered some eggs, and the waitress said, "How you like your eggs?" I said, "Oh, I like them, boy." She said, "I mean, how you like them cooked?" I said, "That's the only way I'll eat them." She threw me out of there, yeah? Well, at one restaurant, there was a one-armed man at the counter next to me, and I felt kind of sorry for the critter, so I said, "Say, old-timer, looks like you've lost an arm." He looked down at his side and then looked up at me kind of amazed, and he says, "I dog as I haven't I?"
When you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you. When you're laughing, the sun comes shining through. But when you're crying, you bring on the rain, so stop your sighing. Be happy again, keep on smiling, 'cause when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you. When you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you. When you're laughing, the sun comes shining through. But when you're crying, you bring on the rain, so stop your sighing. Be happy again. Keep on smiling, 'cause when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you.
That was Sweet Georgia Brown, accompanied by the Whirligigs. You like that name, huh?
Yeah.
The Whippoorwills, that's it. And yours truly, Smiley Burnett, playing the hum strum. That's a gum boot strung up with barbed wire, and you pick it with your teeth.
Trouble, trouble, why do you treat me so?
I go out on a party to have myself some fun. Along comes old man Trouble and puts me on the run.
Trouble, trouble, I find it everywhere I go.
Hey, somewhere.
Way down that lonesome railroad, I hear a whistle blow. I'd like to be there with you, but trouble won't let me go. Why you're always near me, it's hard for me to see. Trouble deals me misery.
Trouble, trouble, I find it everywhere I go. Trouble,
I'm down. I never do have peace of mind as long as you're around.
Trouble.
The Whippoorwills singing that song with Sweet George Brown. And by the way, that was an original by Roy Lanham. Wasn't it, huh,
yeah,
Roy?
That's right, Polly.
Oh, that's a good job you just done, dude. Hey, look who's come in here.
Hey,
hello. Tall and tall, Slim Wilson just come in. Slim?
Howdy.
You know, a fella like you does my heart good. I don't know whether you listeners know, but old Slim here, he gives homeless dogs a home. They go by his house and he takes them in. I do the same thing for homeless chickens, you know what? Yep. I've been getting along pretty good, though. You got to catch them with the meat. The feathers don't count, you know. Hey, let me ask you something, Slim.
Okay.
Dogs down there, you raised so many of them. If you was to cross a pointer and a setter, what would you get?
Why, a poinsettia.
Oh, mercy.
Come look at her roll. There she goes in that cold. Watch her fly. Look at her sail. letter, bye, bye, bye. Marble mail, watch her go. Look at her steam. Hear her blow, whistle and scream like a hound wagging his tail. Dallas bound, 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 marble mail. Engineer making a plan. Tracks are clear. Look at her climb. See that freight clearing the rail. Bet she's late, late, late. Fireball rail.
Hey, fellas.
Yep.
Thanks, Slim Wilson. Hey, I got a little gossip for you. Gather around. Mm-hmm. Well, sir, the law finally caught up with Oscar Hawthorne.
Oh.
Yes, sir.
Did it?
Oh. Wilbur McGinnis was riding by on his horse. That's the marshal, folks.
Oh, yeah.
Well, sir, I thought that Oscar maybe had scratched his nose with his thumb at the marshal or something. At any rate, Wilbur decided that he'd take Oscar down to the ranger station. I found out later that they suspected him of having a campfire that started a forest fire. Well, what I'm getting at, though, is that when Wilbur told Oscar that he was under arrest, the wind whipped Oscar's hat off and it went sailing down the street. Can I go get that hat? Oscar says to the marshal. No, you don't, Oscar, says the marshal. I ain't as dumb as I look. You stay here and I'll go get that hat. Well, sir, let me get my harmonica out here, boys. I'm going to be a hillbilly like old Slim here. Which end's the hall end of this thing here, Mark? Here we go. We used to throw a dance down Colorado County on the top of a big high hill. Didn't need any band, for we knew a man that they called Harmonica Bill. When the caller called out his do-si-do, old Bill blew fit to kill. You could feel that beat go right to your feet. What a man, Harmonica Bill. With a turkey in the straw and a high tucker tall, you never have felt so chipper. Dance all night by the light of the moon when Bill plays Golden Slippers. And a high tuck-a-toe, you never have felt so chipper. Dance all night by the light of the moon when Bill played Golden Slippers. Now little Sophie Ann used to go to the dance and all of the boys would thrill. But she had eyes for one man there, that was Harmonica Bill. Little Sophie danced with not a soul there, so to keep her off of the shelf, old Bill would keep that music going and dance with her himself. With a turkey in the straw and a high tuck-a-toe, you never have felt so chipper. Dance all night by the light of the moon when Bill plays Golden Slippers. Today, gang, but we got to go now. We'll be seeing you soon, folks, and until we do, this is old Smiley Burnett saying, speak well of me, and I'll dare you to talk about me.
Bye now.
You've been listening to the Smiley Burnett Show with Sweet Georgia Brown and the Gay Rancheros, music by the Whippoorwills, and starring Smiley Burnett. Joe Slattery speaking. The Smiley Burnett Show is produced and transcribed in Hollywood.
A syndicated broadcast from 1950 of the Smiley Burnett Show on Tuned to Yesterday. Smiley Burnett, best known as an on-screen sidekick in Westerns with stars like Roy Rogers and Gene Autry. That show was from the height of his movie career, in the period co-starring in as many as 8 pictures a year. This is an hour of collection curios, bringing you lesser-heard programs from the past, and a dusty one is next, not from the trail, but from the open road, with a broadcast from the Thrills of the Highway Patrol series. This show, usually heard in the late afternoon on the Mutual Broadcasting System, alongside other daytime shows of its type, like Terry and the Pirates, Dick Tracy, and even the Tom Mix Ralston Straight Shooters program, this episode, in fact, features the true crime story of the man who stole actor Tom Mix's car from June 15, 1938.
The scene opens. Leo Burt, age 25, arrested by Highway Patrol Officer August Chute for the theft and wrecking of motion picture actor Tom Mix's sedan, is being sentenced.
Leo Burke, the court finds you guilty of the crime of grand theft and sentences you to the term of 90 days in the county jail. In determining the sentence just placed upon you, the court has taken into consideration the plea made in your behalf by Mr. Tom Mix and your age. The court reminds you that should you be hailed before this court again for any crime whatsoever, you will not receive any leniency.
Say, kid, your stitch is about up, ain't it?
Yeah, Skinny. Tonight's the last night I'll be sleeping in this lousy jail cell.
Hold it. Here comes the screw.
Well, Burke, how does it feel to be spending your last night in jail?
Fine, Bill. But I'm plenty glad I'm getting out of here in the morning.
It doesn't seem like you've been here 90 days already.
Say, it seems like a darn sight longer than 90 days for me. But I guess I'm getting a break at that.
Yeah, you sure are, son. Being sent up for grand theft like you were. If Tom Mix hadn't made that plea for you with the judge, you might have gotten a year in the big house instead of 90 days in the county jail.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess I'm pretty lucky, all right. Hey, that Tom Mix is really a right guy to go to bat for me that way.
Well, son, I've been a jailer here for a long time. I've seen a lot of them come and go, and if you'll take my tip on it, you'll stay out of trouble from now on.
Well, I certainly ain't got any kick coming for the way I've been treated by you and the other jailers, Bill.
Oh, you ain't a bad boy, Burke. You just needed to get a little sense in your head. I guess maybe me and the other boys figured the same way as the sheriff about you. That's why we made you a trustee and treated you like a man. We figured you might get off on the right foot this time.
Well, I want to thank you anyhow, Bill.
Ah, that's all right, son. Just watch your step from now on. By the way, got any ideas what you're going to do after tomorrow?
No. No, but I'm going to look for a good job someplace.
Ah, that's the stuff. Where about you going to look for work?
Well, I thought I might try getting up toward Brentwood. I'd kind of like to get some work on a ranch or outside someplace.
That's a good idea. Well, 10 o'clock, time for lights out. I got to be getting along. This is the last time I'll be seeing you in here, Burke. I hope.
Yeah, don't worry, Bill. I won't be coming back this way very soon. And thanks again for all the things you've done for me while I was here.
Forget it, son, forget it. Say, by the way, did you sweep out them corridors in the district attorney's office this afternoon?
You bet I did. The corridors are all swept, and say, I really cleaned up the DA's office. Slick as a whistle.
Fine. Well, just make sure you steer clear of trouble. So long, son, and take it easy. The sheriff will give you $5 in the morning when you leave. That'll help you get started. And good luck to you. Good night, Jack.
Thanks, Bill. I'll need it. Both the $5 and the luck.
Say, kid, what do you mean about the crack about cleaning up the DA's office slick as a whistle?
You ain't getting nosy, are you, Skinny?
Take it easy. I ain't no squealer. But I know you got something up your sleeve about the way you said about this.
Oh, yeah? Well, take a look at this.
Jeez. Say, kid, you've done all right.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll be doing all right tomorrow when I get out of here, too. Say, you the driver of that taxi over there?
Yeah, you want to go someplace?
Yeah, I want to go to Brentwood. How much is it?
Brentwood? That's quite a ways. That'll cost you about $7.
Well, I ain't got that much money. What'll it cost me to get up to Pittsburgh? I got a job coming up there.
Cost you $5 to go to Pittsburgh, buddy.
$5, huh? Ah, oh, come on. Be a pal. I got to get up there in a hurry if I want that job. Will you cut it down a little?
Well, I shouldn't ought to do it, but I'll take you up there for $4 if that'll help you out at all.
Hey, that'll help me out plenty. Come on, let's get going.
Wait a second. Let's see your money.
What's the matter? Don't you think I got $4?
Sure, sure. I think you got it all right. I just want to make sure, that's all.
Okay, here. Here's your $4. Now let's get out of here.
I shouldn't be doing this, but any time you can help a guy getting a job, I say give him a hand.
You're doing me a real favor, pal. Hey, how long does it take to get to Pittsburgh?
Not very long. I'll be there in no time. Well, here we are in Pittsburgh. Where do you want to get off?
Pittsburgh, eh? Hey, I really ought to get over to Brentwood before I see about that job. Say, I got $1.10 here, pal. How about taking me on over to Brentwood like a good guy? I just got to get over there.
Sorry, young fellow. As much as I'd like to help you out, I just couldn't take you on to Brentwood. Tell you what I will do, though. I'll take you as far as Antioch for $1. You ought to be able to hitchhike a ride to Brentwood from there.
Okay. Here's your $1. Is this Antioch we're coming to now?
Yeah, this is it.
Well, how about taking me a mile or so on the other side of town? I can thumb a ride easier out there.
Well, I've brought you this far. I guess another mile won't hurt any. Say, how come you didn't stop off in Pittsburgh if you had a job all lined up there?
A job? Oh, yeah. Well, I got to get over to Brentwood first, see? I want to do something over there before I start working.
Well, this is about as far as I can take you. I'll pull right up here by the crossroads.
Now, come on. Be a good guy, will you? Take me a little further on.
Hey, listen, young fella. I've been a plenty good guy to you already this morning. I'm not making anything out of this joyride. This is as far as I can take you. You'll have to hitchhike from here. That's the road to Oakley over there. Best I can do for you.
The best you can do, huh? Listen, pal. Feel this in the back of your neck?
Hey.
Turn your head around real slow and take a good look at it.
See, what is this? What are you doing with that gun?
What do you think, chum?
You can't get away with
it. Shut up. From now on, you're doing as I say. And if you know what's good for you, you won't try anything funny. I don't want to have to hurt you. But if you don't watch it, get what I mean?
Yeah, I get you. What do you want me to do?
Just get this car rolling for the time being.
Where do you want to go?
Just keep driving towards Brentwood.
Brentwood, we're coming to now.
All right. Roll up your front windows. And don't try hollering when we pass through this town. One peep out of you, and I'll let you have it right through the back of the neck.
Okay, I ain't gonna try anything.
Well, it won't be healthy for you if you do. Hey, what's all that crowd up ahead in town?
Looks like a carnival. To the Ferris wheel and 10th and
12th. Yeah, I see them all right.
Hey, lay off. Hey, quit poking me with that gun.
I just want to remind you that I got this gun back here. That's all. I just got out of jail, and there ain't nobody that's going to take me back. So don't get any funny ideas.
Don't worry, I'm not taking any chances.
Hey, isn't that a highway patrol cop up there directing traffic?
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
All right. You take it easy. You better slow up a little. And don't go trying to attract his attention. I'm watching everything you do.
Hey, maybe I better roll down this window, in case I have to signal or something.
Okay. But don't forget, I got you covered. Say, I think that cop's looking at us.
I can't see, is he?
Yeah. Now, don't... Hey! Look out!
Officer! Officer, get the man in the car!
He's
got a gun! He's
going to
shoot!
Look out! Hey, Squealer! Maybe
this will
hold you.
All right, you drop that gun!
Oh, yeah. Take that!
Look out, you people!
Keep back there! All right, you stop or I'll shoot!
Got him, Arthur. He's down.
All right, keep back, you people. Here, let's see how badly hurt he is. Run and call an ambulance, will you, fella? I've got to get him to a hospital right away.
Is everything ready, Miss Carter?
Yes, doctor.
All right. Alcohol. Probe. Hand me a hemostat. Sponge. Probe. Hmm. Well, suture. Scissor. Dressing. All right. Have him taken to Ward A.
Yes, Doctor.
I'll be in my office talking to the officer. Will you stop in on the way back with the report?
Yes, Doctor.
Well, Doctor, what's the verdict?
I'm sorry, Officer Hine. There isn't a chance that man will live. He can only last a matter of hours. So you'd better talk with him as soon as he regains consciousness.
Hello, Copper. Well, I guess there's not much hope, huh?
What was the matter with you, son? Why did you do it?
I just thought I was too smart, I guess. Knew too much. I just got out of jail this morning. Old Bill, the jailer, friend of mine, was good to me. Told me to steer clear of the trouble. Say, how's the cab driver?
He's all right.
That's good. He was being good to me. Nice fella.
Say, where'd you get that gun you had, Burke?
I swiped it out of the DA's office yesterday. Say, will you tell old Bill, the jailer? He was right. I was just a fool after all.
Thrills of the Highway Patrol from June 15th, 1938 on the Mutual Broadcasting System. To wrap this hour of relatively rare shows from radio's past, we bring you a series that amplified the talent of one of radio's great voices, Paul Frees, as he portrays every voice in the story featured on the show, The Player. Truly a ubiquitous voice on the air, Paul was a regular announcer and actor on the thriller anthology series Escape, often heard on The Suspense Show in various parts, and also in prestige drama like the NBC University Theater. Between his radio and movie work, along with his TV roles as Boris on the Rocky and Bullwinkle show, and even as the original voice of the Pillsbury Doughboy, he really earned his industry reputation as the man of a thousand voices. In 1948, he was given a chance to really show what he could do in a program originally called Studio X, but quickly renamed The Player. It's Paul Frees at the helm in this next syndicated broadcast.
Steve Brody picked up a pickle from the free lunch counter of his Bowery saloon. Steve glared with contempt at the handful of nickel beer drinkers that lined the bar.
Nobby, John L. Sullivan ain't got a lot of small-time grifters like this in his place. Why? Because John L.'s got a name. He's heavyweight champ. Now, we got to think of some way to get a little publicity for this emporium, Nobby.
And thus we begin another story by The Player, starring America's most versatile actor, Mr. Paul Frees. We'll be with you after a worthwhile message from your announcer. The Player, Mr. Paul Frees.
How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? This is The Player, welcoming you to our presentation of First Citizen of the Bowery.
The sightseeing bus had turned into a street that was once proud and haughty, but now was broken and lined with derelicts.
rubbernecks from the sticks were getting a look at the Bowery.
Ladies and gentlemen, here is one of the most historical scenes in this great city. Steve Brody's famous saloon. Steve Brody, the daredevil who made the breathtaking leap from Brooklyn Bridge, was once the pride of this neighborhood. Yes, can't you just picture him now standing at that old bar there, with a pearl-gray derby tilted over one ear, a loud checkered suit, and pink-striped shirt, the kind Steve always wore.
It's like I was telling you, Hobby. Unless we figure out some way to get publicity for this joint, we may as well fold up.
Yeah, I know, Steve. You know, if you was only a fighter like John L. Sullivan, if you could get a little notoriety for yourself, that'll make folks come in and shake the hands of Steve Brody, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I could run John L. right off the block here.
If only I could think of some way to bring in the customers.
Hello, Brody. I just thought I'd come in and see how the competition is faring. Not so good, I see. Well, you better come over to my joint. Diamond Jim Brady's there with a large party.
John L. Sullivan, champion boxer of the world and champion pub owner of the neighborhood, stood in the doorway and laughed.
Oh, Brody, you little fellas will never learn. Once a small fry, always a small fry.
Is that so, you big... Well, it's brains, not brawn, that counts. I'm working on a plan now to make me the biggest man in the Bowery. Don't forget about you, I'll be so famous.
Oh, really? Why don't you jump off Brooklyn Bridge, Brody? That'll give you a reputation. So long, Brody. I'll come over to the poorhouse to see you.
John L. departed, a glint of divine enlightenment came into Steve's Irish eyes.
Hey, Nobby, do you hear what that big mug said? Jump off Brooklyn Bridge. He was kidding about it, but it ain't a bad idea. In fact, I'd like it very good.
Oh, sure, you're joking, Steve. You'd get killed if you tried it.
No, Nobby. I can hear the paper boys hollering now. Steve Brody, popular tavern owner, jumps off Brooklyn Bridge. Daredevil creates sensation.
You know, that's very funny, Steve. Hey, you're a card. A veritable card.
You'll see, Nobby. Steve Brody's place will be the most celebrated bar in New York town. Steve is going to perform the most breathtaking feat since Captain Webb went over Niagara Falls in a barrel. Steve Brody's going to jump off the Brooklyn Bridge.
Gallagher, the cop, looked up from his nickel beer. He'd been listening to the conversation.
Steve Brody. If I see you within a city block of the Brooklyn Bridge, I'll run you in. There'll be no monkey shines disturbing the peace of this neighborhood.
Steve had made up his mind, however. This daring feat would be just the solution to his business problem. And it would make that big bully Sullivan sit up and take notice. Steve ambled down toward the bridge. He began to feel funny. Warning voices seemed to tap him on the shoulder and say,
"Pretty high off that bridge, Steve, and dangerous, too.
Remember that fellow Odlum, Steve?
Odlum tried to jump off Brooklyn Bridge at the grand opening in 85. Rather unfortunate, too. He broke every bone in his body. Yeah. Poor Odlum."
Steve arrived at the foot of the bridge. He loitered idly, surveying the structure, when a uniformed figure loomed up out of the shadow of the building.
Well, fancy seeing you here, Brody. Now, what brings you to the great Brooklyn Bridge?
What do you think, Gallagher? Why, going to Brooklyn. Is there a city ordinance against that?
No. And there's no city ordinance against me asking you either, Brody.
Hubert Malone. Pardon me, Gallagher. There's a customer of mine going across in his wagon. Hiya, Hubert. Give us a lift across, will you?
Sure, hop on, Steve.
The old wagon rumbled down to the bridge. A 1 cent toll was in force. Steve showed his generous colors by flipping the collector a shining copper.
Allow me, Hubert. This is on me.
When the wagon reached the watchtower halfway across the bridge, Steve stepped from his seat beside the driver into the back end. Suddenly, he waved his derby madly and broke into a little Irish jig, tapping his feet a la Pat Rooney on the pine boards of the wagon. The Bowery, the Bowery. They say such things and they do such things on the Bowery, the Bowery. I'll never go there anymore.
Hey, have you gone dippy, Steve?
Yeah, this is my big moment, Hubert. Next time I see you, I'll be getting the key to the city. You did me a service, and I'll take care of you. Then you won't be driving a lumber wagon all your life. Well, so long, Hubert.
Steve suddenly jumped from the wagon to the ground. He tore to the side of the bridge, yanked off his derby, and tossed it overboard. In a split second, he stripped off his shirt, topcoat, and jacket, and was down to his red flannels.
That's indecent, Steve. Put your clothes back on. Get back in this wagon.
You don't have to go swimming with your clothes on, do you, Hubert? One for the money, two for the show, three to make ready, and four to go. So long, Hubert!
And there he was, Steve Brody, arms overhead, 120 feet in the air, hanging like a monkey from a tree. He poised for a second to get his balance, and then all at once, like a gymnast on a bar, he swung back and forth in the breeze, red flannels flying in the wind.
Help, police! Man overboard! Man committing suicide! Help!
But Gallagher had sensed Steve's escapade and had taken the first trolley across the bridge. Hopping off the car, Policeman Gallagher collared the frightened Hubert.
What's the matter with you, you idiot? Where's Brody?
Well, what are you grabbing me for? There's your man.
Gallagher tossed the frightened chap aside and raced to the rail, but too late. Brody was already hurtling downward, straight as an arrow. Nobby the bartender, waiting in a tiny rowboat below, was seized in breathless panic. Steve's body crashed into the East River. Nobby couldn't see a sign of him.
Oh, poor Steve. He was a good fellow, all right. Got to his mother and everybody, and he... Holy smoke, look at him! He's up and he's okay, too!
Steve's head popped out of the water, red-faced but smiling. He began to paddle around.
Hey, here, get in here, Steve boy. Right into the boat. Here, hold on to my hand. All right, here we go!
Well, I done it. Didn't I, Nobby? I done it. I'm famous, Nobby. We're going to have the best business on the Bowery. I done it, Nobby.
Quiet, gentlemen, quiet. I don't think I have to introduce myself to you. I'm John L. Sullivan, pugilist and friendly competitor of the illustrious Bowery Citizen, whose popular establishment we're all gathered in tonight. I give you the greatest of all daredevils, our own Steve Brody.
Gee, thanks, John L. This is the proudest moment in the history of Steve Brody's place.
And indeed it was. Steve was riding on the crest of a wave. Take a chance, Steve Brody did, was the catchphrase of the hour. Customers by the droves had come from uptown, from out of town, from far and near, just to grasp the hand of Steve Brody and drink a toast to him in his own bar. Here was Steve Brody, first citizen of the Bowery. Yes, it was all too magnificent. Tears came into Steve's eyes.
Nobby, the bar's gonna be a gold mine.
Yeah, Steve, but it's getting kind of late. 3 o'clock, Steve. Maybe we ought to call it a night, huh?
What's that? Oh, excuse me, Nobby. Here's Gallagher, the cop. I gotta go and greet him. Hello, Gallagher. Good to see you. Have a drink?
No drink, Steve.
Why not, Gallagher? Celebrate with me. Biggest people in town are here. All of John L.'s classy trade. Diamond Jim Brady, Commodore Vanderbilt, Mr. Astor.
Yes, yes, yes. I know, Steve, but... Well, I'm afraid they'll be back at John L.'s tomorrow night.
Hey. What's that, Gallagher? What are you talking about?
Well, Steve, you... I'm going to have to padlock this place. Take away your license.
Hey, you can't do that. After I risked my neck jumping off that bridge and got me all the business in town?
Well, you see, I'm afraid you made your jump for nothing, me boy. Even the great Steve Brody can't serve drinks after hours.
¶¶
And that's another play by The Player, your one-man theater, Paul Frees, who portrays all of the parts. Mr. Frees will return after a short visit with your announcer. Citizen of the Bowery was written by Ben Pearson and produced by Sam Kerner, with music composed and performed by Rami Idris. Special effects by Fred Cole. Your announcer was Gary Goodwin. Won't you join us again when we present another exciting story for your entertainment? This is The Player, Paul Frees, saying goodbye. Until next we meet.
The Player, on Tuned to Yesterday, a syndicated episode first heard in 1948. And that closes the curtain on all of the voices we heard in this hour that, on the whole, maybe haven't been heard in quite some time on the air. I hope you can be with us again for more collection curios from radio's golden era on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for listening.